You're tuning into the Real Estate Diversification Podcast, hosted by trusted and experienced real estate attorneys who are also seasoned real estate investors themselves. Are you ready to explore unique real estate investing opportunities? Ready to learn about emerging trends and new ideas? Your hosts will help you understand the practical and legal complexities of a myriad of real estate investments so that you can maximize your potential and achieve financial freedom. Now, listen in and get ready to learn.
Get ready to learn.
I am your co-host today, Jonathan Gilmore. Today, I am joined by Doug Rainey. Doug is an attorney at this firm, been here for about a year. Doug has a unique experience I'm excited to hear about today, and I know you will be as well. Doug's background is in the single family development field, and today he's going to talk to us about this asset class. So welcome, Doug. Doug, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, before we dive into the topic?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. So basically, shortly after graduating law school back in 2010, had an opportunity through a family friend who knew about some raw land that was being liquidated by a golf course's holding company. They were selling the course and several parcels of raw land in Lawrence, Kansas. So, we just kind of figured it was ripe for development. The housing market had been slow for a few years. You know, this was shortly after the 08 crash, and, you know, there was quite a bit of pent up demand. So, we just decided to dive in. You know, we kind of built out our team and put together our business plan and, went forward.
So you mentioned the kind of macroeconomic factors. You and I are about on the same timeline as far as law school. And I remember, you know, 2009, that it was, it's tough going from a job perspective. And I realized, you know, I wanted to be a real estate attorney at that time. Wasn't a lot of work. So what kind of gave you the idea or just the impetus to just jump on something, even though we're still in a recovery mode, it felt like at that time?
Yeah, very much so. A lot of it was just trying to take advantage of the price. You know, just we knew that we were going to buy it at a heavily discounted price just because, you know, they were motivated to sell and real estate prices were so low. And, you know, it was mostly just trying to time the market. You know, we had a feeling that, you know, eventually people were going to need somewhere to live. And so few new homes had been built over the prior several years that we just kind of predicted that the market would be, you know, going back up based on that. And, you know, it was very much a guess. It was an educated guess, but it was a guess. But, you know, fortunately, we guessed correctly and the market did start to bounce back. So, you know, we're able to, you know, move those lots fairly quickly.
Oh, that's excellent. So you decided, you were approached by a friend of the family, and kind of where does it go from there? I mean, it seems like it's a big undertaking. And just for the audience, you know, my background, I spent several years as in-house legal counsel doing land acquisitions for a publicly traded home builder. I did land acquisitions from Phoenix to Jacksonville. So I kind of understand what it takes, and it's a heavy lift. So for those interested in investing in this asset class, like, Doug's got a unique experience. So I'm just kind of curious, where do you start?
Yeah. Well, so a lot of it is just kind of a back of the napkin analysis, you know, just kind of looking at, you know, what's it going to take to acquire the land? What's it going to take to put in all the infrastructure? What's it going to take, you know, in terms of human resources, all the consultants, you know, engineers, lawyers, all of the above, you know, to get you across the finish line and, you know, estimate a rough timeline on how quickly you're going to sell these lots, you know, what's it going to cost to service debt and kind of go from there and start, are we going to be able to offer, you know, a reasonable cash on cash return to our investors. So, you know, we're pretty conservative. We tried to be conservative in both what we'd bring in and, you know, not underestimate all those expenses. And, you know, even after all that, we thought we had a pretty good deal. So the most important thing is that, you know, just make sure you're not missing any expenses. They're going to sneak up on you and make sure you're kind of realistic about, you know, all of the above. Cause, you know, one of the biggest things is banks were very leery at the time because a lot of them had to foreclose on a lot of developments like this. So I think we had to pitch this deal to probably 25 different banks. And we had maybe two or three offers to choose from out of those 25, you know, a lot of them just said no. So, you know, that was certainly a lot of it was getting the debt financing. And then on the other end of the equation is the equity side. You know, we were able to get about 2/3 financed through a bank, all of whom, you know, wanted a recourse loan with guarantors. And that's pretty standard these days. So, you know, then you have to pitch it to, you know, your equity side, which really comes first is getting your equity side on board. That's, you know, believes in the deal enough to want to sign that kind of note. And, you know, if the deal goes south, that they're willing to, you know, hold the bag for, you know, potentially several million dollars. So, those are kind of the main two parts of the equation is pitching your, you know, your investors on that sort of deal. And then, you know, getting it financed through a bank.
So, yeah, I can imagine the lift on that. So you mentioned before, part of this is kind of it went from back of the napkin, it sounds like, to a, you know, plan slash pro forma for just the equity.
Yeah,
side,
yeah.
For the debt side.
Exactly. So, you know, once you kind of get your investors on board with the, you know, the general idea of it, of course, then they're going to sign the actual, you know, bank documents. So, you know, once you kind of get your investors on board when you're pitching to banks, yeah, you'll put together a more detailed business plan, you know, a lot of tax returns, financial statements for everyone involved, any limited partner owning at least 10% generally, you know, that can vary from bank to bank, but that, I think that's pretty standard. Certainly all the general partners involved, you know, they want to see that. And yeah, just kind of a more detailed projection of all the expenses and all the revenue. Yeah. So, you know, and then you have to kind of decide what's the business plan going to be in terms of what are you going to sell? You know, our approach probably more so than most single family developers was to sell dirt. You know, we would put all the infrastructure in, you know, after we bought the land and then just sell the lots to other builders. Whereas, you know, a lot of developers try to keep all that in house. And, you know, a lot of developers, the developer will be the only builder. You know, you won't even have a choice on who you build with. Whereas, you know, with our development, you'd pretty much build with whoever you wanted. You know, we had a builder as part of our general partner team, but the significant majority of the lots in our development were actually built by other builders who turned out to be our biggest buyers. You know, we had a handful of end user buyers, some of whom used our builder, some of them used other builders, but probably 80% of our lots we just sold to our network of builders. So that's why I recommend if you get involved with this sort of investment, before you get too far into it, network with your local home builders association, because, you know, whether they're your direct buyers or, you know, their own built buyers, customers, you're going to want a lot. If you're a development, it's certainly in the developer's interest to have a good relationship with as many home builders as possible.
That's a good advice. So, you know, you mentioned your back, you know, had a good low land basis, right? You could, timing the market, and you did so correctly, by the way. So well done on that. Then you moved into debt and equity and raising capital. You've kind of talked about your plan, your projections. You had mentioned kind of the team, right? So
yeah.
What does that look like? What types of personnel do you need? What did you realize, you know, hey, maybe we could have done better on this, you know, if on the next development, or maybe, hey, we should have had this person sit in this spot. You know, I always think about consultants and what that means and
yeah,
you know, how you use them. So can you speak a little bit to the types of team members you brought in, consultants and otherwise?
Yeah. So our key consultant really was our land planned architect, kind of doubled as our general consultant just because, you know, he had been through this process so many times. So that's the first thing I'd say, you know, is if you're interested in, you know, being a developer yourself on, you know, a deal like this, first of all, to really take a look at the land and make sure, you know, that the numbers work, you know, why is it for sale? Is the price rise, the price negotiable, and, you know, terms, you know, making sure that, you know, if you can get an option, that's a lot better than just buying it outright. You know, we were able to give ourselves a full year's option, for, you know, I think maybe 0.5% down, something like that. So, but, getting back to your question about the team, just kind of a general consultant that's been through the whole process, I would say is really helpful. One of our general partners is a home builder and general contractor. Highly recommend having someone like that on your team. If it's not an internal person, like just one of the partners, I would recommend trying to find someone like that as a consultant, just because they're going to help you analyze your bids. In general, when you're putting your pro forma together, you know, you're going to rely on your engineers, who's another key part of your team, to kind of put together some help you with cost estimates. your general contractor will really be able to kind of help you with that. And in our case, we were generally able to negotiate the lowest bid down an additional, 20-25%, just because they had a good sense of what every part of that bid actually entailed and what it should cost, based on the local market. So that will definitely be in your best interest, because, that obviously that's going to help your margin tremendously to be able to negotiate those costs down. Generally, it depends on the cost of land, certainly, but at least in our case, the infrastructure was about double the cost of the land. So that's going to be by far your biggest expense. You're going to want a real estate lawyer. So definitely bring them in early in the process, because, I was fresh out of law school. So our lawyers helped identify some issues that, we didn't. So that's certainly going to help you. Things like drafting easements, drafting your, restrictive covenants, things like that, that's a, key part of your team. Another thing is a real estate agent, and your commissions on all of your lots are actually going to be one of your biggest assets. So it helps to have someone like that in your team internally that kind of sees those commissions as part of the compensation for, when you're general partners. If you do need to go, outside for your real estate agent, I would certainly recommend negotiating that, because that, 3% of the, or 6%, usually it's going to be split down to 3, of your gross sales is a massive, chunk of revenue just to be handing out to some outside agent. So I would certainly recommend finding a way to keep that in house if at all possible. And, I don't know if this is something you could call part of your team, but we tried to develop a strong relationship with the local planning staff at the city as early as possible. And, our consultant helped us with that a lot, but that I would say is a very important part of your relationship, just to get this city staff on board with your project. Cause it's almost inevitable that you're going to have pushback from, the neighborhood, your surrounding, neighbors to your development, and a lot of questions get asked the planning commission stage, city commission stage. So, having a working relationship with city staff, kind of rather than you're feeling like you're fighting them, it's going to make it a way easier process. You're very much fighting an uphill battle if city staff recommends, denying your project. It's just a lot harder to get planning commission approval and city commission approval if city staff has problems with your project.
Well, and you brought up a great point. Just to let the listeners know, there's a few ways to buy single family development land. You had mentioned some of what you're buying, you're selling to individual builders, right? From a land acquisition side, so in this instance, you bought farmland, right? Was it zoned agricultural at the time, and you had to rezone it to single family to residential? Is that what?
Yeah, ours was a little bit unusual, where there was already some zoning in place. Ours was kind of a mixed use development between neighborhood commercial. I mean, we're still getting through some of the commercial side of the development. The residential side is long gone. But what you described is a more typical process, where it'll be zoned agricultural, and then you'll go through the whole rezoning process. But at any rate, the process we went through, it was the same thing, where you have to have a preliminary plat that your engineers will be doing the heavy lifting on that, and submitting it to city staff. And then you'll have planning commission review, and if you get through that, eventually city commission review. Finding your engineer is going to be very early on in the process, after you get the financing side figured out.
So you had an engineer involved early on. You sounds like you had someone on the city side who you could help navigate. You had a GC consultant who had, had this, rode this rodeo many times before. So you kind of had a team in place of knowledgeable people that you could work with on the outset. And just to touch on this, this is a zoning, this is an entitlements project, right? You've got to have entitlements done before. There's a single family developers can buy at final plat, right? So, or even pre-plat really, but where the dirt hasn't moved, but you've got plats that the engineer has drawn, right? And it's said, hey, there's 100 lots. Here's where the roads are going. Here's where the horizontal infrastructure, I'm talking sewer, water, et cetera. And then another stage you can buy at, which is what some of your builders did, which is finished lot condition, right? So there's grading that's happened. you get it basically, you know, topped off, you've got roads in and that horizontal infrastructure. So really you're just buying the dirt that's ready to go vertical on, right? So it sounds like you offer that to some other people. I can tell you from my experience that the entitlements is, and kind of what we're talking about, the risk profile for entitlements is it's much more risky than buying a finished lot that's already been through the city, which can be a problem, right? I mean, I've seen deals, you know, die at planning commission. I've seen, you know, yeah, city council flip, you know, in entitlements hearings. And so there's a little bit of a risk there. That's, I think that's part of the reason why you said, find someone who's on the inside who you can, you know, at least talk to or help navigate it.
Yeah, and we had votes against this at the planning commission stage. You know, we were 5-0 at the city commission stage, but you know, our the neighbors to our project, you know, we scheduled neighborhood meetings to try to smooth things over as much as possible. But you know, at the end of the day, they hired an attorney to, you know, fight our project, and you know, I believe it was 6-3, you know, that we got through the planning commission. And at that point, you know, we were already tens of thousands of dollars deep. So you know, certainly something you'd want to disclose to any of your investors that, you know, there's a risk that it's going to die at the planning commission stage or it, you know, at another part throughout the process. You're not going to get all the permits you need. Your preliminary plat's not going to get approved. So, you know, of course, you want to limit your expenses as much as possible. You know, and ideally, I'd recommend not taking down the land. Certainly, you know, we didn't, but before
you got ahead of that was my next question.
Yeah. So that's kind of where that option comes in handy, is just kind of convincing the seller, hey, you know, if you want to sell this, you got to kind of work with us here. Cause you know, we can't commit millions of dollars to buy this raw land only to find out that it's worthless to us if we can't get our preliminary plat approved. So, you know, fortunately for us, the seller was motivated enough to sell that they were, you know, willing to sign the preliminary plat and all that while they still own the land. And then, you know, once we got through and our financing was fully in place, we're able to go ahead and exercise that option and close. But certainly I'd recommend against putting the cart before the horse and buying this land, playing, okay, you know, here's what we're going to do. And then you get shot down by the planning commission or city commission or anywhere else in the project, and you're stuck owning land, you know, with debt attached to it that you can't develop. So
yeah, well, that's a good point. And sorry to jump in there, but what I've seen is, you know, the sellers are selling, that basis is higher, right? Because they're selling 2B single family lots, which is a higher basis than if they're selling farmland in most situations. So you're buying it with the basis of expecting to get these entitlements approved. And there are some aggressive home builders. I would say that you've seen, and this probably happened in 2006, 7-8, right? Where you've had people get real aggressive. They're buying before pre-plat's approved, and maybe they get approved and then it's worthless. But a lot of times what you said, what can happen is you don't get it approved at all. So yeah, you've got a very inflated high with debt ridden land on it, which is why a lot of builders will buy on, at the very least, a pre-plat approved. I happen to know several who buy on final plat only, right? So
yeah.
And then to your point, who's doing the entitling now? Well, that's where you got to give and take. Is it, you know, me as the potential investor buyer, I'm paying for all the entitlements, and it could be, you know, $100,000-$150,000 with a consultant and a legal team, et cetera, to get that through commission, to get it final plat approved. Am I paying the landowner to do that? Sometimes developers own the property, right? And it's very rarely are farmers develop, you know, getting entitled. Sometimes they do, right? But who's doing it? And then what also comes up a lot is, who owns the rights to those plans? You know, you just spent, you know, you've got an engineer and a consultant. You know, it sounds like you own the rights to the plans, but you didn't own the land until a certain trigger and, you know, a certain hurdle was met. And then things kind of changed a little bit.
Yeah. So. And that's all negotiable, you know, in terms of whatever agreement you have with the landowner. But yeah, I mean, to the extent that you can, you know, keep all the rights to your engineering and all, any third party reports, anything like that, you know, the better off you're going to be, you know, just to kind of, you don't want to unnecessarily add a bunch of value to the seller's land that you're not going to end up buying, just because if you need to, you know, amend your contract, change the terms, you just give yourself more leverage that way. Cause you know, if you've already dumped, you know, let's say $50,000 and added value to the seller's land, and hey, you know, we need to negotiate an extension, you know, to our option, something like that, there's going to be significantly less motivated to grant that to you if they know that they get to keep all of your engineering work that you've invested into their property. So
that's right.
Something to consider up front.
Yeah. And to that point, timing, we saw, during the pandemic that even if you had everything, all your ducks in a row, the city was only meeting, half or a quarter what they were. So everyone got pushed out. And sometimes the contracts, this is the seller, right? If you're representing a seller, and as a lawyer, we've both been in this position where they want to know, when do I get my money, right? When am I closing? When are they hard on the earnest money? And in entitlement deals, it's a longer process, right? Because it's like, yeah, you might be hard on your, initial earnest money deposit, but that's not really where the deal can come into problems, right? It's a year later, right? It's when you think the plans are going to be approved. And in the pandemic, we saw, oh gosh, our timeline's off. So, we have got clients who are renegotiating those timelines at a price sometimes, right? Because now that leverage has switched to the seller side.
Well, and that's why I always like to recommend, and as you know, we do this with all of our clients generally, is, don't just use the broker's form. If you're making an offer on listed property, don't just, go with the broker's form. You should draft your own contract, because that way you can bake in all those terms you want, that a lot of sellers don't really read with a, fine-tooth comb, but matter a lot. Not the least of which is that option language, because you'll have times where the sellers kind of sees the dollar amount. They're like, okay, great. But they don't realize that, hey, you're giving yourself plenty of time for minimal money to basically, roll the dice on putting this deal together. When we first signed this up, we didn't have our financing in place. We didn't have, any city approval, certainly. And we just kind of say, okay, well, we're willing to, again, I don't remember the exact earnest money deposit, but it wasn't a ton relative to the size of the deal. Let's say $5,000-$10,000, what for what ended up being like an $8 million project between the land and infrastructure cost, just to kind of roll the dice on putting that together. Unfortunately, we're able to, but it was a situation where, we had our seed capital from our investors, and if the deal had fallen apart at any stage, we could have walked away and we would have lost, the earnest money. So I would say negotiating yourself as much time for as little earnest money as possible is going to be certainly in your best interest.
Yeah, that's a good point. So just to recap, at this stage, you've got an option to buy. You're going through zoning. You've got everything approved, right? And whether that's pre-plat or final plat, you get the approvals you need. And then at some point, you've purchased the property. So you own the land. You've got the approvals, and now it's kind of like, oh, what's next? It's development, right? So what do you? You mentioned restrictive covenants. Like, did you approach that kind of like at the same time as you're doing development, laying down easements? I mean, you said you had a commercial component to this. How many phases did you have? I kind of was just curious, like, what happens after that, and what happened to you, and what did
So
you do?
we had three phases, and there's some pros and cons of splitting it up. So the advantage to do everything all at once in one phase is you're going to tend to save on infrastructure cost. So, I think we had about 55 total acres, of which about 15 was commercial and the rest was single family residential. And almost always in these mixed use developments, the residential sells first and then the commercial follows. And that's certainly what happened to us. We decided to split it up just because of the market. Lawrence is a, it's a college town, about 100,000 people. So it's not necessarily going to have the same, demand for new construction as Kansas City would, for example. So we didn't want to basically compete against ourselves by flooding the market with, 40 acres of single family residential. So we started with a little over half of our single family inventory. And that just, again, it took advantage of the fact there wasn't much else out there. So, it kind of kept the price up. We did take the business strategy of pricing very aggressively right off the bat, just because, like a lot of limited partners, our investors were concerned not only return on investment, but return of investment. So they're and particularly getting, the bank note how, paid off, because again, everyone involved that was at least 10% had to personally guarantee a, multi-million dollar note. So the and I that's even more true today than it was when, we started this back in, 2011 or so. Is, prime is quite a bit higher, so if you're gonna, be undertaking a project like this with interest rates where they are right now, first, I'd want to use that as leverage when you're buying the land. Try to negotiate the price of the land as low as you can, just saying, hey, no one's gonna pay you top dollar right now when debt is as high as it is. And I would also kind of take the approach, you know, unless you can really afford to, you know, ride the wave, is just to try to knock out that debt as quickly as possible, even if it means, you know, charging 20% below market for the first third half, whatever, the development, just to get the banknote out of the way. And, you know, and at that point you can maybe hold out for more money, because, you know, there's always the risk the market's going to tank. You know, let's say that, you know, we were lucky that the demand went up shortly after we bought the land. Let's say it crashed even more, you know, when 08, you know, turned into the next Great Depression. You know, if that had happened, you know, we're in trouble. So you just kind of take some chips off the table by getting your banknote paid off. And, you know, your investors obviously aren't going to be thrilled if they don't get a good return, but that's a much better case scenario than defaulting on your banknote. So that's at least the approach we took. I mean, but I would say that's probably even better advice today than it was when we did it, just because of, you know, higher interest rates.
Yeah. Well, and to that point, you kind of touched on it earlier, is, you know, there's phases as far as development, but there's takedown phases. You know, some developers, some home builders will say, hey, look, we want to buy 300 lots, but we're going to buy them, you know, 100 lots at a time, you know, so that minimizes their risk. And then you've got, you know, now you're really relying on the engineering and, you know, what's spine, what's required, you know, is anything in phase three needed now? And a lot of times the spine rows, something like that.
So that's a good point. Yeah. And that's a really good point, is we did install some arterial infrastructure, you know, sewer trunk line, for example, was a big one. Some of the infrastructure that we had need for all three phases, we did up front, just because there's an efficiency there, you know, because every time you bring all those crews out, construction crews for your, you know, contractors, it's going to cost money. So, you know, for some of those, it made economic sense to put that in, even though it was, you know, 4 years before we knew we'd actually need it, just because it was a lot cheaper to do that all at once.
So you've got the horizontal you're working on, you know, you're getting ready to, you've got it platted. So we know where the homes are going to go. And so when do you get, did you build a model? I mean, you said you had different builders. So were there multiple builders with models? How do you control what types of houses get put in there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So our builder contractor partner had a pretty good sense of, you know, who built what. And we kind of wanted to set the right tone. I mean, there's a lot of really successful builders in town that just tended to address a different price point than what we wanted for the development. So we actually said no to a couple different buyers that built perfectly adequate homes, just because we knew that they weren't the exact type of home that we wanted to have go in, you know, especially early on. So, you know, that's a big part of it too, is we did not do a model home, particularly just because our business model was more selling lots than it was building finished homes. We did do a few, but that's just not the approach we chose to take. I mean, again, a lot of builders do, it's just not what we did. But if you are going to sell to other builders, you know, we did what we called an architectural control board, where we essentially gave ourselves veto power over everything that was built. Just because, again, if you, you know, build a, you know, hideous neon greenhouse with, you know, crazy architecture early on, it's going to dramatically lower the value of the rest of your development. So, you know, we just kind of want to, and we weren't, you know, we want to make ourselves easy to work with. We certainly didn't want a reputation for, you know, nitpicking exactly what went in, but we just kind of wanted final say to make sure that nothing went in that was going to, you know, lower the value of the rest of the development.
Now to touch on that, did you hand it off to an HOA at any point in this development?
Yeah, absolutely not. So I mean, that's something some developments do. We had restrictive covenants, you know, that kind of said, you know, you can't build a shed of a certain size. And, you know, we basically just kind of relied on our lawyers and our consultants to, you know, base that off of other developments that they've worked on. But we chose not to go with an HOA. I've personally invested in single family houses that had HOAs that made them a lot harder to sell. People just tend not to like them from my experience. Mm-hmm. You know, not only you have to pay a monthly fee, but you just kind of give your neighbors a lot of power over your own property. And a lot of people just don't like that. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. It depends on the market, depends on the area, but we just chose not to go that route.
Yeah. Well, and it's a good point you say that, because in some developments, you might be required by the city to put in, you know, a fully amenitized, you know, amenity center, pool, et cetera. Yeah. And then at that point, you know, if there's not a metro district or something like that, you're really beholden and have to create an HOA because there's going to be a payment component of that, which comes with all the trappings that you just said that were in a lot of ways can be negative. And we all kind of heard, you know, a lot of horror stories about HOA or experienced them, which I have as well. So, and I just want to touch on, just kind of wrapping up here. I'm going to be doing a multi-part series on residential development. So, whereas this is a great to hear kind of the overview from Doug today, I'll be talking about, you know, what you need in the due diligence phase. We'll be, you know, survey, engineering, phase one, soil reports, how to get through building permits and, you know, joint development agreements, how to work with other home builders, things like that. So that is coming. If you want to learn more about that, we are going to be releasing a multi-part series. So Doug, any other things, any other tips that you would say for someone looking to either invest or just kind of generally, you know, be a general partner in one of these deals as we move forward?
Yeah. I mean, so I would say if you're going to be a general partner, just the key is the team, you know, cause you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, you don't want to, you know, dive in and make yourself the steward of, you know, millions of dollars of your investors' money without knowing what you're doing. So I think just the key is bring on people that have done it before, you know, and so the key is, you know, just to build out a good enough team where your main job is to put out fires and just have everyone, you know, doing what they're doing and kind of overseeing all that, you know, kind of the best way to, you know, avoid mistakes. And, you know, from a limited partner's perspective, if someone approaches you with a deal, is just to, you know, really ask all those questions up front, you know, make sure that the, you know, general partner with whom you're considering investing has answered all those questions, you know, that they know why they're buying the land that they're, you know, buying, that they've really looked at the market and, all their pro forma assumptions are reasonable, you know, based on that market, that they really have a good sense of debt and, you know, the schedule of, you know, projected sales and all that, rather than, hey, you know, this looks like it'd be fun to develop. So, finding a general partner that, you know, knows what they're doing and has that good team together before you give them the money, I'd say is definitely important.
That's great advice. So, hey, Doug, thanks for sharing your story today. I know it was a lot to talk about. We could probably talk for hours on this, but appreciate it. And appreciate everyone for joining us today. And as always, invest wisely. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the Real Estate Diversification Podcast. Did you enjoy the episode? Visit www.rediversification.com to tune in to more exciting episodes and free information and tools that will help you succeed. Leave us a review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and our other social media channels at the RED Podcast. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time. Missouri Bar Advertising Disclosure. Neither the Supreme Court of Missouri nor the Missouri Bar reviews nor approves certifying organizations or specialist designations. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.